Today on the 21st Show, it's been 1 year and 1 day since President Trump returned to office. From dismantling much of U.S. foreign aid to attacking Venezuela to fixating on the acquisition of Greenland, America's place in the world is much changed from January 2025. Today we'll hear from two Illinois voices about that. Ian Kelly is a former career U.S. diplomat, now serving as ambassador-in-residence at Northwestern University. And Nicholas Grossman is a professor in political science at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We also want to hear from you. What do you think about year one of the Trump administration as it relates to the rest of the world? 800-222-9455 is the number to join us. 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And it's been 1 year and 1 day since President Trump returned to office. I could spend the next hour listing everything that's happened since then, as he did in a news conference earlier this week. Deep cuts to the federal workforce, ending funding for public broadcasting, deploying federal agents to American cities with helmets, face masks, and high-powered rifles. Trump has also directed the Justice Department to prosecute his perceived enemies, such as former FBI Director James Comey and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. And he created a cryptocurrency where anyone from anywhere in the world can send unlimited amounts of money to the president and his family. We could talk about all of that, but I want to begin today by talking about what President Trump and his team have done to America's place in the world. Former Vice President J.D. Vance promoting far-right political parties in Europe. Trump's man, Elon Musk, spending a weekend, quote, feeding USAID into the wood chipper. And Trump himself becoming fixated on the U.S. acquiring Greenland. America is viewed quite differently than it was just 1 year ago. The Prime Minister of Greenland told his constituents that they need to start preparing for an invasion, even though he says it's not likely. And some of our closest allies are talking about America in the ways that our leaders used to talk about some of the worst governments in the world. Many top business and political leaders have been in Davos, Switzerland this week for the World Economic Forum. That includes Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada. Let's listen to some of what he had to say yesterday, followed by President Trump's response just a short time ago.
We knew the story of the international rules-based order was partially false. That the strongest would exempt themselves when convenient. That trade rules were enforced asymmetrically. And we knew that international law applied with varying rigor depending on the identity of the accused or the victim. This fiction was useful. And American hegemony in particular helped provide public goods. This bargain no longer works. Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition.
Canada gets a lot of freebies from us, by the way. They should be grateful also, but they're not. I watched your prime minister yesterday. He wasn't so grateful. But they should be grateful to us. Canada lives because of the United States. Remember that, Mark, the next time you make your statements.
Joining me now to talk more about America, Trump, and the world is Ian Kelly, the ambassador in residence at Northwestern University. Kelly began his career in the U.S. Foreign Service in the last years of the Soviet Union. From 2010 to 2013, he was U.S. representative to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE. And finally, he was America's ambassador to Georgia, which, like Ukraine, is a former Soviet state that has been targeted by Russia. Ian Kelly, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
And listeners, you can join us today. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. All right. I just want to start with a broad overview, sort of a temperature check. It's been 1 year. What are you thinking about where we are now?
Well, I think we're in a different world now, internationally. I think that the Prime Minister of Canada really laid out how different the world is now, with the United States not behaving in a cooperative way, as it has in the past working multilaterally through international organizations, particularly through NATO. And we've seen this administration pull out of multilateral organizations, pull out of treaties. And I think that reality has really hit a lot of people in the whole transatlantic community over the last really few days with this really very, very destructive threat to the territorial integrity of a NATO ally. It has been really an extraordinary year. I feel like a pinball in a pinball machine, and it's really kind of foreign policy by impulse rather than by consensus. So, yeah, the Carney speech, I think, it should have been a wake-up call. I think he intended it that way.
What has been going through your mind listening to the president's increasingly, I don't know if warlike is the correct term. I guess, to be fair, he says that he would not invade to take Greenland, although, you know, the man is not known for necessarily comporting present actions with his past statements. So we'll put it that way. What does it mean that, that he has this increasingly warlike rhetoric around Greenland?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. I'd say one thing is that he's really, he's not behaving as a traditional president, or at least the presidents that we've had since World War II, the kind of rhetoric he uses against Europe, for example, demeaning them as weak, and saying that the U.S. Gives so much to NATO and gets so little. Well, he has really taken a lot out of NATO by suggesting that the U.S. will not adhere to its NATO treaty obligations and not defend countries that he thinks we shouldn't defend because they're not contributing enough.
You know, he addressed that exactly this morning at Davos. Maybe we can let's listen to some tape just on him and NATO. This is about a minute. It's a lot of tape, I realize, but I think it's important to hear the president in his own words from just a short time ago in Davos talking about NATO.
So what we have gotten out of NATO is nothing except to protect Europe from the Soviet Union and now Russia. I mean, we've helped them for so many years. We've never gotten anything, except we pay for NATO. And we paid for many years until I came along. We paid for, in my opinion, 100% of NATO because they weren't paying their bills. And all we're asking for is to get Greenland, including right title and ownership, because you need the ownership to defend it. You can't defend it on a lease. Number one, legally, it's not defensible that way, totally. And number two, psychologically, who the hell wants to defend a license agreement or a lease, which is a large piece of ice in the middle of the ocean where, if there is a war, much of the action will take place on that piece of ice. Think of it. Those missiles would be flying right over the center of that piece of ice.
I don't want to be flip about it, Ambassador Kelly, but let's say, you know, the president was a student. If he was one of your, you know, a student in one of your classes at Northwestern, what would you make about his assessment there?
Well, I mean, it's pretty easy to rebut what he just said. I mean, we get a lot out of NATO. I mean, I guess I should preface it by saying that for decades we have been cajoling Europe to spend more on defense. I mean, we've had American presidents even call them kind of, free riders. I think Obama called them a free rider. So it's true. We do spend a heck of a lot more on defense than they do. But to say we get nothing out of NATO is not only untrue, it's absurd. We get a lot out of NATO. We get the ability to project power. there are things that we could not do if we didn't have access to bases in Europe, like Ramstein in Germany or Lake and Heath in the UK. We get lots of diplomatic leverage by having a forward presence in Europe. And we also historically have done a lot to minimize nuclear proliferation. Part of the bargain is of the U.S. nuclear umbrella is that these great powers, these large economies in Europe, will not build nuclear weapons. But if we go to from collective defense to U.S. acting alone, that's exactly what will happen. You'll get countries like Germany and Poland developing nuclear weapons. So we get a lot out of NATO. And anybody, I think, who's worked on these issues, either in the State Department or in the Defense Department, knows this, how important NATO is. So I could go on, but I won't, Brian. You get my point.
I do get your point. And maybe it's worth reminding listeners that only one country has ever invoked Article 5 of the NATO agreement in its history, and that was us.
That's right. That's after September 11th, right. And our Afghanistan operation was a NATO operation.
With many, and you can remember, I still remember getting the press releases about U.S. or even Illinois troops working with Polish troops and working with troops from this country and that country. And now, of course, European countries are talking about invoking Article 5. I don't know if you'd say it against the U.S. or in case of U.S., hostile action, invasion, if you want to use the colloquial term, of Greenland.
Yeah, I mean, there is something. There's also the preceding article, Article 4, which calls on countries that feel that their territorial integrity is being threatened to convene a NATO meeting. It's never been convened because of the threat from another NATO member, but it has. Turkey most recently did it because of Syria. I just can't imagine why a U.S. president would say we get nothing out of NATO. It's absurd.
I was also struck, sticking with Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, he was on the cover of the Wall Street Journal on Saturday, or the front page, I should say. It showed him shaking hands with Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, and it said the two agreed to a new strategic partnership. And, quote, Carney said Canada's close economic ties with the U.S. are over and China was more predictable. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, that I hope is hyperbole. But, I think that he is just trying to highlight how unpredictable the relationship with Washington has become. So I'm hoping that's what he meant. But he also called for what he called middle powers to no longer rely on the U.S. But to diversify their relationships, and that's what he did by going to China. I don't agree with him that somehow that China is more predictable, more friendly, and it certainly doesn't share the values that the NATO alliance purportedly shares anyway. So I think it was a way to just kind of knock the president upside the head that Canada and other so-called middle powers are not without levers to deal with this bullying that the president's doing.
And apparently there's some method, and I don't know how familiar you are with the details of this, where some of the European nations could go to the United Nations and claim, trade the president is trying to sort of force, coerce, I should say, countries to go along with this plan. And that would lead to some potentially significant trade consequences for American businesses.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we're already seeing the beginnings of it. I mean, yesterday the bond market was experienced a kind of sell-off of U.S. treasuries, which, of course, could have a real economic impact on us. It would raise inflation and slow economic growth if it continues. And there are people who think that this is really the only constraint that Trump feels he has, this ability to sell off to sell off U.S. treasuries, which, of course, finances our huge debt.
Just about a minute and a half until we need to take a break. But is there a legitimate strategic interest for the United States in Greenland? I mean, we do have military bases there already. Is there like a sort of steel man argument for what Trump is doing?
Yeah, again, he is kind of setting up a straw man argument, saying, you know, we can't do this unless we own it. That's just patently untrue. There's a 1951 agreement with Denmark that we can build bases in Greenland. I mean, we had over a dozen bases during World War II. So it's just not an argument that holds water. There's plenty that we can do through this bilateral agreement that we have with Denmark, and also through the NATO alliance. NATO has been slow on the uptake, but they're starting to focus on the Arctic, and so this could be a NATO operation. But that doesn't appeal to the monarchic impulses of our president.
Yeah. I mean, he used the word psychologically. That's what he said. Psychologically, who the hell wants to defend a license agreement or a lease?
Right.
Which is a large piece of ice in the middle of the ocean. All right. We are going to take a break. We'll have more with Ian Kelly, ambassador in residence at Northwestern University. 800-222-9455 to join us today. 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about year one of the Trump administration, specifically as it relates to foreign affairs. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. We also asked members of our texting group about this. Fawn in Champaign mentioned that her brother, or I should say their brother, has been a resident of England since 1990, married a British citizen. They have grown children living in London, and they're probably going to be continuing to live there. Fawn says, I am appalled that our president cavalierly threatens to militarily attack and take over Greenland. This is breaking our NATO alliance. What if war is started by our president? Will I never again be able to visit my brother, sister-in-law, and nieces? You can join us today, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. We're talking about this with Ian Kelly, former United States Ambassador to Georgia. He was U.S. Representative to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, a spokesperson at the State Department, and Director of the Office of Russian Affairs in Washington, D.C. Today, again, Ambassador in Residence at Northwestern University. I'm curious what you've thought about how America's position on Ukraine has evolved in the past year. There have been ups and downs. Vladimir Putin got to visit the United States for the first time in I can't remember when. What do you think about how that has been changing and evolving in the past year?
Well, I think, Brian, you know that I have been a very strong supporter of the United States helping Ukraine defend itself against an aggressor who does not recognize either the borders of Ukraine or even the sovereignty of the present government. I was very gratified, at least until 2025 that the U.S. Congress voted a number of packages to send arms to Ukraine. I have been very disappointed that the Trump administration has basically said, over to you, Europe. The defense of Europe is no longer a priority. We are no longer providing arms to Ukraine. Europe has stepped up. The problem is that we are going to soon, or Ukraine is soon going to run out of the ammunition, the shells and the missiles for their defense. The pipeline is going to run dry, and then what? I don't want to demean the attempts to try and bring peace to Ukraine, but I have been very concerned about the seeming, let's just call it, the lean towards the Russian point of view, which would reward Russia for its illegitimate territorial gains in Ukraine in return for stopping the war. I mean, that's not going to happen because Ukraine won't do that, and Europe won't support it either. But it is, again, it is a very different approach than from the previous administration.
Let's go to the phones at 800-222-9455. We have John calling from somewhere in Illinois. John, thanks for calling in.
Sure, you're welcome. Thinking about the Denmark issue and Greenland, I haven't really heard much on the news and so forth from Denmark regarding what their interest is in Greenland, even though they're controlling Greenland. What is their actual purpose there? And even though they were ceded Greenland or something after World War II, what is the real argument for them to continue to have control over Greenland? And even though NATO may really need Greenland, and I don't necessarily disagree with, I mean, I don't necessarily agree with Donald Trump's methodology. I don't think you're going to draw people in. Honey is using honey rather than vinegar is advisable. But I just haven't heard much from Greenland in terms of, okay, this is why we're here, or Denmark, why we're here in Greenland. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Good question, John. Thanks for that. Ian Kelly, I don't know if you can speak to the history. I guess Greenland was once a colony of the Danish kingdom, but take it where you will.
That's an excellent question. And I think it could be answered fairly easily or fairly quickly, that the very small population of Greenland, which is not much bigger than the city of Highland Park, where I live, maybe it's 20,000 bigger than Highland Park. It's about 50,000 people. They have their own autonomy. They have their own prime minister, their own parliament. And the short answer to your question is the majority of people in Greenland like being part of the not just Greenland, but also the EU. The EU provides a bunch of economic benefits to its members, particularly countries that are underdeveloped, such as Greenland is. So it's a democratic decision whether they want to join the US or they want to join the EU. And from everything I've read, their elected representatives have said no to the idea of Greenland being annexed by the United States. And Brian, it does go back to about the 18th century. It was a colony, but it does have its own democratic, political autonomy.
Is there a parallel, I wonder, with some of the U.S. territories? You know, if some country decided Puerto Rico would be in their interest to have it be a part of their, you know, China or something, Russia or something like that. I mean, is there any sort of metaphor we can use with America's own territorial footprint?
Sure. Yeah, Guam or Puerto Rico. I don't know what the arrangements are with the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico in terms of them seceding from being, you know, part of U.S. territory. But it would come down to doing a free and fair referendum about which way they wanted to go, I suppose, join whatever China or wherever.
Well, before we make news, just a hypothetical on our part, just a hypothetical. Let me ask you.
Very hypothetical. I can't imagine it happening.
But
it is a good analogy, though.
Well, while we're talking about the Western Hemisphere, what do you think? What have you made of the Donroe Doctrine and our strike on Venezuela and deposing the leader there, but not really, it seems, having much interest in the sort of pro-democracy opposition in Venezuela, despite the fact that the leader of that apparently gave over her Nobel Peace Prize to President Trump?
Yeah, well, that's a whole nother kettle of fish there. I think that this whole thing was sold to us and under false pretenses. It was preceded by the designation of this one part of the regime in Venezuela as being narco-terrorists, giving us the right to destroy and kill the sailors or whoever they are on these boats that are trafficking drugs. And of course, the naval buildup around there was predicated on dealing with the narco-terrorism. It turns out that wasn't the goal at all. It was just to remove the president, but while keeping his regime, also all of those members of his regime who are so-called narco-terrorists have been left in place. It was really about acquiring or getting back, as the administration said, our oil in Venezuela, and giving the president, I guess, the right to call himself acting president. So I think it's part and parcel of this impulse of our president, this acquisitional impulse to acquire as much territory for the United States as possible. I mean, we had presidents like that in the 19th century with expansion into the West, taking over territory from Mexico, taking over the Philippines, et cetera. But we haven't done that for over 100 years. Seems like we're going back to it, though.
All right, let me remind listeners, we are talking with Ian Kelly, ambassador in residence at Northwestern University, about 1 year of the Trump administration and what that has meant for our standing in the world. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. 800-222-9455. And I want to bring in another voice now, someone we have talked with about these topics and more in the past few years. Nicholas Grossman is in political science, a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, also senior editor at the news site Arc Digital, and author of the book Drones and Terror, Asymmetric Warfare and the Threat to Global Security. Nick, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Hi, good to be back.
So you're joining us straight from class this morning as we are going to air. So I'll tell you that Ambassador Kelly and I have already talked about some of the NATO and Greenland stuff that's been happening. But maybe we can start with your sort of perception, and if you have anything to add on the Donroe Doctrine and what we saw happening in Venezuela. I got to check my calendar. Hard to believe it was only a few weeks ago. Feels like a year at this point.
I think when you combine the Venezuela stuff with the stuff we're seeing with Greenland and Europe right now, what we're seeing is more of a shift to the U.S. being a regional power that focuses on its sphere of influence. In fact, acts more like a, a regional bully, sort of in the way that Russia has acted towards its neighbors of trying to control the hemisphere and pulling back somewhat from being a global power. Even the reference to the Monroe Doctrine is that where the US sought to dominate the Western Hemisphere, but not get involved in the affairs of the European powers and largely not extend American power beyond the Western Hemisphere.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I've heard some people who I guess you would say are former neocons, some of the people over at the Bulwark who say, you know, America's ambitions used to be a global power, not just a regional power. This is actually like a diminishment of our ambition. What do you make of that take?
Oh, very much so. That the Trump and some other Trump officials have been complaining in currently in Switzerland at this big meeting in Davos, have been complaining about how unfair a lot of this stuff in the international system is to the US. And that is backwards, that it is the US-led international system. America set up a lot of it in the aftermath of World War II. And the US was the first global power, really the only global power in history, that had so many voluntary allies, that did not have partners based on conquest. I think the Soviet Union, the Red Army marching in and saying, you're with us now, whether you like it or not, that the US didn't have that, had a lot of voluntary alliances with Canada and European countries and NATO, with Japan, with South Korea, with a number of countries around the world, also, non-allied partnerships. All of those were set up in a way that benefit other countries, but keep the United States placed at the top with a special role in various international institutions. Good example of this, the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO is always an American military officer, and other NATO allies have at times placed their soldiers under US command, which is something that doesn't really happen for anybody else. So the US with that system was much more of this global power, the one superpower, hyperpower, especially after the Cold War bestriding the world. And by trying to undermine, rip up, damage those relationships, and by making it where it is no longer in the interest for other countries to be supportive of a US-led international system, of accepting America as the number one, because they also get some benefits from it, economic benefits, security benefits from it. Instead, it's shifting the world to something more like the 19th century before World War I, a more multipolar world where countries sought to join up to balance against aggressive powers, as opposed to joining up against a, at the time would have been with, say, the British Empire, of supporting the British Empire, and instead a lot of powers balanced against them. And so we're starting to see some of that now, of countries joining together more and only little steps in that direction, but joining together more to hedge against the United States, with a good example being Europeans putting some troops into Greenland, that those would be troops that would usually be working with US commanders on joint interests, and instead now are working on trying to deter the United States from trying to take territory from them.
Well, Ian Kelly, your career began in the Foreign Service when it was a bipolar world, and then it was a unipolar world for much of your time. And what do you make of this? Are we truly becoming a multipolar world, for better or worse?
Yeah, I think Nick is absolutely right. I think that we're looking at, and the Russians would call it a tripolar world, by the way. It would be, so Washington and the Western Hemisphere, Russia and in Europe and Northern Eurasia and China in East Asia, it is I think a much more dangerous world when you have these great powers that are calling the shots in their own spheres of influence. I think we had a much safer world when there was a consensus that there would be no more spheres of influence, because these spheres of influence, I mean, there's going to be there are going to be lines between them that will be under contention, and that will be, I think, causes for conflict. And I think we're also a lot weaker without the support of Europe. They are an economic superpower, maybe not a military superpower, but I mean, we basically double, I think, our economic power, and close.
Yeah, and a big market for U.S. products, most certainly. Products,
yeah,
and services.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we're gonna take another break on the program. We'll continue with Ambassador Ian Kelly of Northwestern University, Professor Nicholas Grossman of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, 800-222-9455. We'll get to some more calls after a break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking on the 1 year and 1 day anniversary of President Trump's return to the White House about America's place in the world with Nicholas Grossman, assistant professor in political science at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, senior editor at ARC Digital, and author of Drones and Terror. Also speaking with former U.S. Ambassador Ian Kelly, was ambassador to Georgia, representative to the OSCE, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, as well as many other postings in a long career in the Foreign Service, presently ambassador in residence at Northwestern University. 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Nick Grossman, you had a piece in early January that asserted America is no longer a constitutional democracy, yet is far from consolidated authoritarianism. It's important to recognize both of those at once. Can we talk through that briefly? What does that mean, America is no longer a constitutional democracy?
So it means that the U.S. is not operating under the Constitution and is not operating under, at least fully under, the provisions of democracy beyond voting. So things like rule of law, for example, that otherwise then it wouldn't be democracy because then the results of elections wouldn't actually make laws, it wouldn't actually count. And we can see this in many different areas, but some really small ones of law breaking and things without consequence of, I don't know, changing the name of the Kennedy Center or changing the name of the Department of Defense, that those are, you know, small and don't matter that much, but are against the law and don't follow the normal procedures, to some really big ones like the White House usurping Congress's power of the purse, where any of the tariffs that Trump has been doing are arguably illegal. They're all under an emergency power in which claiming that there's an emergency, even though there isn't one. And a lot of spending that the White House has been canceling goes directly against what Article 1 of the Constitution says, that Congress has the power of the purse. It is something that, I mean, all American kids learn in school. And the White House has been doing that instead. Or we can look at the actions of ICE and the Border Patrol in Minnesota, in which they are violating rights and not granting people due process, and in which both, you know, from ranging from violence, even shooting somebody, killing somebody, but arresting people, putting them in jail or in some sort of holding without explaining the charges against them. And there are a number of these provisions where the U.S., by the various political science scores that mark a full democracy, or then what would be called a mixed regime, and then at the other end of it, an authoritarian country, that the United States has gone through a process, what they call democratic backsliding, but has backslid from the full democracy into more of that mixed regime, or what is sometimes called autarky or competitive authoritarianism. And this is something I think a lot of people miss in that many conceptions of how does government work is either like democracy or dictatorship, that those are the two options. And really, there's a whole lot in between. And we are in that in-between area now, so that there are still some functions of courts. There are some court rulings that the Trump administration illegally ignores, but there are some that they follow eventually that they do adhere to. So courts have had some role, but not a complete role. There's been some role for Congress in budgeting, but not none, that elections still play a role. It's not like there have been elections ended in or completely manipulated, like, say, in Russia, for example. It's more in a way of somewhat partially a little manipulated, like we've seen in perhaps worse instances, but examples of this in the 21st century. We've seen things like this in Hungary, India, Peru, Venezuela before Maduro, that with under his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, another example, but where somebody who gets elected through a legitimate democratic process And there are some questions about with Trump's 2024 election, given violations of the 14th Amendment. But either way, from via election that then in office seeks to proceeds to dismantle a lot of the checks and balances and other features of democracy. And so the U.S. is somewhere in between, and it is uncertain about where things are going.
Ian Kelly, your Foreign Service career went, you know, covered the period of sort of democratic blossoming in Eastern Europe and also some of the democratic backsliding, I think. What's your perspective on what Nick said and what you've been seeing in America for the past year as it relates to your, you know, sort of experience in Europe?
Yeah, I think the way that the administration ignores the oversight role of Congress, believes it has the Supreme Court in its pocket. I think that you know, the Constitution is always a matter of interpretation, and their interpretation is that the Constitution, Article 2 of the Constitution, vests executive power in the president, and they've interpreted that to mean that he has a power to eliminate entire agencies, which he's done, fire people at will, which he's done, and basically has complete authority over foreign affairs. Of course, that ignores some of the aspects of Article 1 that sets up Congress, that gives Congress power to declare war and to raise funds, as Nick says, the power of the purse, and of course, advise and consent on foreign affairs. And other appointments. So I think we could be faced with a kind of a constitutional showdown or a constitutional crisis. There's the Supreme Court is supposed to be ruling on the constitutionality of Trump's use of tariffs for political purposes. You know, most recently, these punitive tariffs against those countries that don't agree with the U.S. plans to acquire Greenland. And this all comes under this whole idea of the unitary executive theory, it's called. And that came out of the Heritage Foundation. But I think everybody's going to be paying attention to this this decision, especially on tariffs coming out of the Supreme Court.
800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. Nick Grossman, the other part of that piece that I mentioned from early January is that we are far from consolidated authoritarianism. I guess that means there's still some, you know, reason for hope or reason for, I don't know if optimism is the right term. Talk about that aspect of it.
Right, so I think so. And I would call it optimism that I am unabashedly more in favor of constitutional democracy than in crime and corruption and authoritarianism. So I don't mind saying that's positive. But the other aspect of it is in liberal democracy terms, the United States is in bad shape. In consolidated authoritarianism terms, though, things are going pretty well. There are a lot of ways that the administration's efforts to violate the Constitution, to try to consolidate more power in themselves, to take power away from both constitutionally by Congress's constitutional authority, but also many areas of civil society that pressuring media, trying to go after freedom of the press, trying to pressure universities and force universities to change the way that they, what topics they talk about or how they teach or to have political commissars overseeing things. That, so all those different ways where they've tried to reach out this additional power means that under liberal democracy terms, bad news, but they have faltered in a lot of ways by consolidated authoritarianism terms. And I'll give you an example I mentioned earlier with the ICE forces in Minnesota. So you have a U.S. city that is effectively under occupation, under armed occupation by the federal government, that there have been forced things like school closure and store closure that, you know, my kids sometimes have to stay home when it snows or when it's just way too cold in the morning. Kids in Minneapolis and St. Paul are staying home because armed agents of the state are going around violating people's rights. And yet, notice how ICE only pops up in one city at a time. They do kind of a bunch of showy operations. They always bring a camera crew and they arrest a number of people and they beat some people up and they make some people disappear, but they do not have anywhere close to do this in all cities at all the time. The vision of people in particular in the White House, looks like Stephen Miller, seemed to think that a lot of these actions, these really harsh anti-immigrant that extend into kind of anti any non-white person or somebody who supports them operations, but that they would be more popular. And a lot of the American public really doesn't like it, that there are people who object strongly, majorities of Americans react very negatively to the occupation of Minneapolis. Things like using military force to take Greenland polls terribly. So even a more authoritarian country than the United States currently is, those governments still need to operate within the constraints of public opinion. If they do something that the public likes, or at least on balance that the public likes, that then they find it easier to operate, they get more support, more people do what they want. And if they do things that people are against, they have to force it on people. And the Trump administration's capacity to force things is limited, and they keep on doing things that reduce their own capacity. So a good example of this is with another violation of basic liberal democracy principles, but where Trump has corrupted the Department of Justice and used it to go after not lawbreakers, but political enemies, and to manufacture cases against, there was the former FBI director, James Comey, the New York State Attorney General, Letitia James, recently tried with the chairman of the Fed, Jerome Powell, who simply because Powell was doing what he believed to be responsible macroeconomic policy instead of serving Trump's political interests. So they opened an investigation into him, have brought up Minnesota officials that have objected to the actions of ICE there. And yet each time they do this, there are a number of experienced prosecutors who resign because they stand on principle rather than simply follow orders to do something that they know is unethical. And that reduces the capacity of the administration to bring these type of frivolous charges against people to pressure them. So when you have with the ICE one, they have about their full capacity in Minnesota right now. And if you compare that to some of the worst instances of authoritarianism, of, for example, Nazi Germany, there were far more people who were working for the Gestapo or the SA or the SS who were violently repressing people. And Germany had a smaller population and a much worse economy and the legacy of World War I to draw on more people into that. And so I think it is important to both recognize that the United States has backslid away from constitutional democracy, that it is dealing with a attempted authoritarian takeover, one that has shifted the type of country that America is. And yet at the same time, the people that are trying to do the consolidated authoritarianism are stumbling in various ways and are meeting more public resistance, especially from a lot of regular people that may be where some societal leaders have weakly folded. There are a lot of regular people, as we can see in Minnesota, among other places, that have been standing up for their neighbors, for their rights as citizens. And that is making the project of consolidating authoritarianism to really shifting the United States until it's something closer to, say, the way Russia operates. Even though the U.S., the Trump administration has managed to move the U.S. a bit in that direction, it has not gone as far as the administration would seemingly like. And there is a good chance that there are real free and fair midterm elections next year, in which then a House of Congress might change hands from one party to the other. And that is not the sort of thing that could happen in a consolidated authoritarian state. Like Putin never, ever loses a parliamentary majority. He simply doesn't allow it.
All right. Well, we are going to have to leave it there. Interesting times. I really appreciate both of your analysis. Nicholas Grossman is professor, assistant professor in political science at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. You can read his work on the site ARC Digital or check out his book, Drones and Terror, Asymmetric Warfare and the Threat to Global Security. Ambassador Ian Kelly is ambassador in residence at Northwestern University. Thank you both for being with us today on the 21st show. I want to mention coming up tomorrow on the program, we are going to continue our series of conversations with candidates for the United States Senate. Republican Pamela Denise Long is an occupational therapist and also a political commentator. You can let us know what questions you have for her and the other candidates by leaving us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. 2171. That's 217-300-2121. That is our voicemail line. If you are driving now, can't write that down, you can always go to our website later, 21stshow.org. We've also got our email address there, our text messaging group, social media, every other way to contact us. We've also got links to subscribe to our podcasts there, or just look us up on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Coulson Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We will talk with you again tomorrow.